We have with us Abby Smith with NRCS, the National Natural Resource Conservation Service. She's our state agronomist for Michigan, and she's here to talk with us about conservation practices for soil health. Abby.
Thank you for having me this morning to talk about conservation practices. We have over 130 practices in our field office technical guide, so we're going to focus on soil health this morning. Just a little bit about NRCS before we begin. For more than 80 years, NRCS has helped farmers make investments in their operations to keep their working lands working and improve the quality of their soil, water, air, plants, and animals. Our mission is to help deliver conservation solutions so agricultural producers can protect natural resources and feed a growing world. We are part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Before we begin talking about conservation practices this morning, I thought it would be important to take a minute and talk about conservation planning first. Conservation planning is the process that we use to identify what conservation practices are needed on the land to address resource concerns. Resource concerns are problems that are impacting the sustainability or the intended use of the land. We have over 40 resource concerns that we work on that range from soil, water, air, plants, and animals. So we use conservation practices to treat those resource concerns. And how this conservation planning process works is that we start first with a problem or an opportunity. And so farmers, you know your land best. As you're working your ground this spring, you can make note of things that you see that need improvement. You can identify resource concerns with a conservation district employee, a MEEP technician, with MSU Extension's help, or with NRCS's help. Once we identify that problem, then we're going to figure out what the goals are for the operation and inventory the resources. And so inventorying the land might be a tool that we run in the office. We may need to collect some data in the field to run that tool. It may be an assessment that we do out on the land. It may be just a visual assessment, us going out and looking at what's going on. Most often it's a combination of all of those in order to get a good picture of what's happening. We use that data to formulate alternatives and determine what is going to be best on that land to address those resource concerns. And we're going to formulate some alternatives and present them to the producer. We really need producer involvement in this process. We want that conservation plan to represent the producer's operation and make sure it's going to meet the producer's needs and fit within their equipment and their crops and continue to help them be profitable. So once we have a decision from the producer about what practices they want to see out of those alternatives, we're going to create a plan. And that plan is going to include maps and soil data and also what we call implementation requirements. So implementation requirements are basically prescriptions for each of the practices. They're going to tell you what to plant, how to plant it, when to plant it, and all the other information. That plan may also include engineering designs if you have engineering practices that you'd like to install. But that plan is going to tell you everything that you need to know to put those conservation practices on the ground. For some practices, we may have financial assistance available. You may have heard of EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, or CSP, the Conservation Stewardship Program, or RCPP, the Regional Conservation Partnership Program. Those are all opportunities for financial assistance to cover a portion of the cost of installing those conservation practices. So the planning process doesn't stop after implementation of the practices. We'll evaluate the success of those practices and make sure they address the resource concern and make any adjustments that are needed. So we can transition and talk just a little bit about soil health for a minute. Soil health, we define it as the continued capacity of the soil to function and be a vital living ecosystem to sustain our plants and animals and us. And so the soils are really important to making sure that we have that physical stability and have a place for those roots to live, cycle nutrients, regulate water, and filter pollutants in the soil. So when we're working with soil health, we use what is called the Cropland Infield Soil Health Assessment. And this is an assessment that we do out in the field. We need some data from the producer because some of the indicators have a timeliness factor, and we'll never be out there right at the right time to do all the indicators. So we need some information from the producer to help complete this. They're pretty simple indicators in that they don't need a lot of specialized equipment. Most of them just take a shovel and a visual assessment to look and get a good picture of the soil. We use this tool to help us determine if the four soil health resource concerns are met. And I'll put a link in the chat when I'm finished speaking right to that tool because it is available publicly. Producers can use it on their own if they don't want to work on it with NRCS. One of the tests that we do is the water stable aggregate test. There's a picture on the screen of the strainer method that we do. A soil aggregate, it is multiple soil particles bonded together with organic matter, and they're bonded together by exudates from plants or mycorrhizal fungi or other soil microorganisms. And that glue helps form those aggregates from those soil particles. And so this water stable aggregate test that we can do out there with just some cups and some sink strainers and a hard surface to turn the soil out on tells us a lot about the soil and all four soil health resource concerns. How you do this test is you take a sample of soil. I like to take a sample from the field edge or fence row and compare it to the field. And you crumble that soil up in your hand a little bit. You don't want to grind it up. You're just looking to break up any large clods. Put it in the sink strainer and then submerge it in the water for a minute. And then you're going to turn it out onto a hard surface. And what we're looking for, the comparison that always sticks with me is, we want cake, not pudding. So we want it to look like chocolate cake, not chocolate pudding. The soil on the left here on the image, you can see the aggregates are still together. There's not runoff coming off of it. If there is runoff, it's usually clear. We can still see those pore spaces, and our soil aggregates did not disintegrate in the water. The soil on the right here has disintegrated. It looks more like pudding. It's spread out. We're not seeing those distinct pores. So we use that test as a measure of aggregate stability, and we use this because it's really important to all the soil functions to have water-stable aggregates. They're more resistant to erosive forces like wind and water, and that pore space is going to help us with infiltration and holding water through the growing season, as well as air exchange. On the screen is another way that we can test that aggregate instability using a mesh screen suspended in a jar of water and telling if that soil clod will hold together in that water. Another resource concern that we look at is soil compaction and specifically management-induced compaction. Compaction is reduction in the pore spaces. So anytime we are applying pressure to the soil, like through traffic, and those soil particles get moved closer together and we reduce pore space, that is compaction. This is going to reduce productivity and infiltration and aeration in our soils as well. Another resource concern, the third one, is soil organism habitat loss and degradation. And we know that most of the soil processes are driven by our soil biology. So it's really important to have a home for our organisms to live and food that they need because those relationships between our plants and the microorganisms are really important, like our rhizobia bacteria producing nitrogen for us in legumes and making our nutrients plant available. And then the final resource concern that we look at is organic matter depletion and all the pools of soil organic matter. So the recently dead to the material that has been dead for a long time. Organic matter is important to stabilizing our soils and cycling nutrients and holding water for us. So when we look at implementing practices, we focus on the four principles of soil health. And so those are maximizing living roots, minimizing disturbance, maximizing biodiversity, and maximizing soil cover. On your screen is some practices that can be used to address those four principles. And so we want to design a system of practices that work together that are going to address all four of those principles to the maximum extent that we can. That's really how we get those resource concerns addressed. And we'll talk a few for just a few minutes about a couple of those. One of our most popular practices is cover crops. It's code 340 if you're looking at our field office technical guide, and I'll put a link to that in the chat as well. These are plants that we plant for seasonal vegetative cover, so they're not harvested as a crop. They're going to protect our soil surface, reduce erosion, and increase soil health for us. Excuse me. So I get this question a lot, you know, what cover crop should I plant? And it's really a combination of factors. We need to look at what resource concern we want to treat to make sure we pick a species that's going to do that for us. We need to make sure it's going to work with the crops that are in rotation, and also our planting and management methods. Especially termination, and MSU Extension has a really great publication on termination of cover crops. So making sure the species that we plant are going to fit within our management. And then another thing that's really important is making sure it fits within our windows of opportunity in our cropping system. So wheat is a great crop to follow with some cover crops because we have that nice long window after harvest to plant those species, and we can plant warm season species because of the timing. And so we start with a great long list of cover crop species, but once we consider all four of these factors, we really narrow it down to a few species that will work really well. Another popular practice, it's actually two practices, is residue management. We have two different levels that are based on the intensity of the tillage that's done. We have no-till and then reduced tillage. And here we are managing the plant residue and limiting soil disturbance in order to keep the ground covered. And there is some air quality benefits and energy benefits as well, and increasing organic matter. Another common practice that we work on is conservation crop rotation. And so this is adjusting the sequence of crops that are grown over a period of time. So that rotation, making adjustments to that to help keep the ground covered and rotate between different carbon to nitrogen ratio crops and including legumes, rotating crop families to help control disease and including high residue species in there as well. So when we build these soil health management systems, we're focusing on those four principles of soil health. We want our soils to be resistant to disturbance events that are happening, and then resilient in that they can return to that pre-disturbance state quickly. And how we do this is by implementing these systems of practices. So all of our practices have criteria that we use to plan them appropriately to address the resource concerns. And that's all going to be in that implementation requirement document that the producer will receive. So on the screen is an example of how we could use those three practices that I just covered to focus in on all four of those soil health principles. And so we would use that conservation crop rotation to maximize biodiversity and maximize a living root. And then the cover crops could help us with maintaining soil cover, maximizing biodiversity and a living root system. And then we can use no-till to help us limit that soil disturbance and maximize soil cover. And so here you can see we've addressed all four of those soil principles and used multiple practices to do that. And then, you know, when we're implementing these conservation plans, we don't intend for the producer to make all the changes in 1 year. The goal is to, you know, work this into the producer's operation so that we maintain yield and we're not having production losses. So here's an example of how we could step into a soil health management system. Starting at the bottom here, a producer that's in a corn-soybean rotation with conventional tillage, their first step might be to start to no-till those soybeans. And then after that, we introduce wheat that's also no-tilled. So we've limited our disturbance there twice now. And then we follow that wheat with a cover crop, maybe a cover crop mix because of that nice long window that we have to establish it. After that, we focus in on starting to no-till the corn as well. We have a higher functioning soil here because we have that cover crop in there and we've done some no-till already. And then the final step might be to add in a cover crop after corn. And so in that kind of final step in this screen. We have the ground covered during all of the non-growing season when the crops aren't present with cover crops or the wheat. We have a lot of diversity in there with cover crop mixes. And we've maintained soil cover as well. So that was a small representation of our conservation practices. Like I said, we have 130, over 130 in our field office technical guide that we work on. If you're interested in starting the conservation planning process, you can scan the code on your screen to contact your local field office. I'll also put a link in the chat to the contact information so you can visit your local field office and ask them about conservation planning. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks, Abby. Next, we're going to have Jeff give us a weather outlook.
Well, thanks, Sarah, and good morning. A frosty morning for most of us here. And I want to spend a little bit of time to talk about that initially here. And again, we are getting to on the calendar and on the climate calendar here as well, towards the end of when we typically see freezing temperatures. But we have a air mass out of Canada that's unusually cold and dry. Over us right now, and I guess the bad news is, of course, we've had a widespread hard freeze in many parts of the state and ongoing right now. But the other part of the news is it's moving, and will be away from us here within the next 24 hours, and then we're looking at a very, very different type of weather pattern setting up here this weekend and for probably beyond that as well. But this morning here, just to give you an idea of the and a couple things we can tell about this particular event here. We're looking at some of the raw meteorological observations here, and the number to note here are and for each of these locations, if you had not familiar with this format, the red numbers are the air temperatures, and that's taken again about 5 feet above the surface. And so this gives us again an idea of where we are. This is a little bit old now, back to 6:25 last hour, but it's similar now. But what you can see across Michigan and much of the upper Midwest is sub-freezing temperatures. Almost all of Michigan, we do have temperatures at or below freezing. A couple things to note, though: some of the temps in the interior upper and in portions of the eastern lower really got down to below, well, what we would typically see this time of the year, some cases even some upper teens, but many areas low to mid 20s, and some mid 20s, as you can see here, as far south as the Saginaw Valley and the Thumb. One thing we can see also from this, as you go towards the south and west in the Lower Peninsula, the temperatures were not quite as cold. There's a example for a few upper 20s and near 30. Battle Creek at this particular observation was 33. There was a little bit of breeze in those areas that kept the temperatures up. The other issue here, the other number, the green numbers here below the red ones, below the air temperatures, those are dew point temperatures, which give us an idea of humidity. And what you can definitely see with this particular event is that the driest air, the lowest humidities, were in northern and eastern parts of the state. That's where we saw the coldest temperatures. So there was a direct correlation with the humidity. Very and to have again some of these sites over, you can see at Bad Axe, for example, an air temperature of 23 Fahrenheit and a dew point of 19 Fahrenheit. 19 dew point for a humid climate. Michigan is a humid climate. That's pretty unusual this time of the year, but a very, very dry and cold air mass for this time of the year. Fortunately, it's only going to be here about 24 to 36 hours. So that's where we are with the freeze. It'll be interesting to see how things shake out. The landscape played a role here with lower areas seeing colder temperatures and vice versa. But we will unfortunately have a little bit of a risk of frost tomorrow morning, but temperatures should be significantly warmer or milder than they are this morning. This is definitely the worst that we'll see with this particular event. Looking at the last week in review here, we saw some ups and downs. There was actually another frost event a few days ago, but overall, the average temperatures for the week turned out to be pretty close to a degree or two above the normal. When we take the long-term averages, there was fairly widespread precipitation across the state during the time on the right-hand side here. Most areas seeing at least a half to 1 inch, so at least normal values of precipitation for this time of the year. A little bit less, some areas less than half an inch in far northern and eastern portions of lower Michigan and portions of upper Michigan. But in general, again, it was a fairly precip was fairly widespread during the week. And that's a theme we're going to talk about here just in another minute or two. We are moving into a wetter than normal period here for the next probably couple weeks. Soil temperatures, I've got a graphic here that I have not shown before. It's because it's brand new. And we're looking here at 4 inch bare soil temperatures for the, well, this is from the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, but it's with our EnviroWeather network here in Michigan, at least the values we have in Michigan. And our 4 inch bare soil temperatures range from the upper 40s. This would be the mean 4 inch soil temperature. So we still have some upper 40s left in the upper peninsula, and then those increase to the around 50 to the low 50s, even to some mid 50s in the far southwestern part of the state. That's where we were on the 23rd. Our soil temperatures this past week, given those air temperature departures, they were pretty steady or fall. They fell a few degrees from where they were at this point last time. What I wanted to bring to your attention here, we talked about a really early start this year because of the unusually warm conditions in February and parts of March. Well, on the right-hand side here, this is a climatology of soil temperature. It's a new product from the Midwest Climate Center. The link to this is down. I've listed it down on the bottom. But it gives us an idea, at least over time. This is something we've never really had before very well. The climatology. What's the average date when the bare or 4 inch bare soil temperature warms above 50? And that's the average. And you can see in Michigan here, if looking, well, it shows the upper Midwest. But for Michigan, you can see that date ranges from late April in the far south. The southeast corner of the state is where we climatologically see the warmest temperatures. Then it moves to the first part of May as we move into central lower Michigan to the second week in May in the north, and then finally all the way into late May or early June as we go into upper Michigan. So, and again, this is the climatological average between 1991 and 2020. So it gives us some kind of historical or climatological context here. But what it all points to, and given the values that you see on the left-hand side, is that just like air temperature, our soil temperatures are warmer than normal than they typically are at this time of the year, probably by a week or two at a minimum. So that we have that going for us, at least in terms of thinking about field work, that the challenge now is going to be more water related. And that's a lot of what we're going to spend our time with here over the next couple of minutes. On our weather map this morning, again, the Canadian origin air mass that I talked about causing the freeze, it's over eastern Ontario and Quebec. That's the big blue H's here. And that's moving off to the east away from us, but it'll be with us for one more day. We should have mostly sunny skies today, really pretty nice day, but it will be warmer than it was yesterday. Probably most areas into the 50s, maybe even a couple places nearing 60, but should be mostly full sun today. Our freezing temperatures with sun coming up right now as we speak should be probably a backup above freezing here with certainly within the next hour or so. So not much more of the sub-freezing temperatures, and then up to our high temperatures. We should see fair skies overnight and for most of the day tomorrow. However, we do have the first of two major weather systems to impact us that will be organizing tomorrow out over the Central Plains. You can see that here, this area of low pressure with a large area of precip and a warm front. This system has a lot going for it in terms of upper air dynamics. The jet stream will be strengthening it. It also has access to lots of Gulf of Mexico moisture. So this is a fairly large system, and yet another one. We've had several of these come and impact us here over the last few weeks. But there will be, with that high pressure off to our east, there will be one more morning where we see relatively clear, calm conditions here overnight. We likely will see some scattered frost. These are forecast minimum temperatures tomorrow morning. And again, you can see that they're quite a bit, several degrees warmer than they are right now or have been overnight. But still, especially over eastern portions, northeastern portions of the state, we will see temperatures back down or maybe a degree or two below freezing. But again, not as severe and not as widespread as what we have right now. So one more cold morning, and then things really change as we move into the weekend. Here's the map for weather map forecast for Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, and you can see that the system has moved from Kansas up to central Minnesota. There's a trailing warm front here, and so what we're going to see with this, with a big surge of moisture coming and actually warm air on the way, that's the other major story. We will see increasing clouds tomorrow, especially during the afternoon, with the development of rain, showers, and thunderstorms by as early as late afternoon, but I think most of it will hold off to the evening. And then that will spread from the southwest to northeast across the state overnight. Most of us will see at least a quarter to half an inch with this particular system. And most of the precipitation should be over by the middle or part of the day on Saturday or early afternoon. But there will be a continuing lingering chance. And it sets a stage also for a second weather system, which you can see out here over the Rockies. That's system number two. That approaches us on Sunday. And so after this particular weather system goes through, we have a second one coming. That will be here probably by the afternoon on Sunday, and then continue on into Monday, even Monday evening, with another widespread 1/4 to half inch or greater. There will be some 1-inch totals probably in that as well. And given the way I mentioned an active jet stream here, there's an active dynamics here, that with the weather system on Saturday, the way that this is set up, there will be a chance that we see some strong thunderstorms between on late Saturday and Sunday. And the Storm Prediction Center here has identified portions of at least lower western and northern lower Michigan as having a slight risk of severe weather. We could see a number of high winds and possibly some hail, maybe even a tornado or two. So something to keep an eye on. It's still a couple days out, but there still is the potential there. And the other big factor here, our temperatures are going to go from way below normal, where they are right now, to much above normal. And we will see, especially across southern and central parts of the state here this weekend, highs well into the 70s. We will probably push 80 for a high on Sunday. So huge, huge turnaround in terms of temperature and going from late winter, early spring, essentially to summer. Our minimum temperatures in southern parts of the state by late in the weekend will not drop out of the 60s. So we are going to see not just a major turnaround and lots of degree days, and with water, lots of things are going to happen in terms of development. Unfortunately, it's also going to be a difficult one for field work. Obviously, people want to get going and moving here, but it's going to take a little time depending on again on how much precipitation falls. And speaking about that, the totals, here are the forecast totals for the upcoming week through next Thursday. And you can see that for much of the state, unfortunately, we're looking at least an inch, some cases more than that, maybe even approaching 2 inches in some northern parts of the state. You can also see here the gradient. The totals are expected to be heaviest across northern parts of the state and western parts of the state, and the least in the southeast. I think that's probably a fairly good bet. So in the southeast, might want to be just ready to go. We're ready to pull the trigger if you do get a break and you're missed by a thunderstorm, because again, that's probably where our totals will be lowest here. But there will be a continuing threat for precip much of this weekend into early next week as well. One other thing to note about this too, this time of the year, it's important to note that with very warm temperatures, and we're going to see high temperatures in the 60s, 70s, and again up to near 80, our evaporation rates will be significantly higher over the next week than they typically are at this time of the year. So that should help. So even if we get rain, there's going to be right now we're looking at least 1/1500ths of at least potential evapotranspiration. Some cases, maybe even pushing 2/10 of an inch with those kind of temperatures. So some of it will be recycled back into the atmosphere relatively quickly. So be ready to go. If there's an opportunity there, you should use that to your advantage. In the medium range forecast guidance here, what you've just seen here, this big pattern change that we're looking at with troughing, upper air troughing out over the western part of the U.S. That's what you have here on the left-hand side here, and then ridging over the Midwest and the East. That's a lot of what the medium range guidance has been consistently calling for. And so both the 6 to 10 and 8 to 14 day outlooks look like this, and very, very strongly call for warmer than normal mean temperatures, and then a range of precipitation totals from maybe even a little bit below normal in the southeastern parts of the state, and then to our south and east to above normal as you move north and west through the state. Again, 8 to 14 day, very, very similar to this, but I think the most important message is here is the above normal temperatures. That very, very consistent. And not only that, for this period, it goes on beyond the first week, maybe 2 of May, beyond or longer than that. We have some new long lead outlooks to look at, and they're consistent with what some of what you just saw. Most of you know we've had an El Nino event in place in the equatorial Pacific here with us since last fall. That's rapidly weakening and decreasing. We'll be back to near neutral conditions, so neither El Nino or La Nina here by probably by the certainly the beginning of the summer and beyond that. But if you look at the forecast values here or the forecast indices for the El Nino Southern Oscillation, what we also see is yes, the equatorial Pacific is cooling down right now as we speak as it goes back to near neutral, but it continues to go past neutral. And by late summer or fall, we have a return of La Nina, the cool event. That's the blue bars here on the right, and the Climate Prediction Center is suggesting as much as an 80% likelihood of this happening. That's not going to influence our weather now or anytime soon. It won't come until probably later in the year, but we'll talk more about that. But as a result of these, essentially collectively, both the new outlook for the month of May, those are the top two panels here, and then both, well, also the seasonal May through July 3 month outlook, and even beyond that into the late growing season, they're all calling for warmer than normal mean temperatures here, looking at the future with no direction on precip. And that's pretty consistent here for, again, for much of the upcoming growing season, but certainly for the next few weeks and then for the early part of the summer, all these things are consistent with one another. So warmer than normal is the, I think, is the operative or the take home message here with our long lead and medium range too. So summarizing here, very active weather pattern across the upper Midwest and the Great Lakes, with major changes after a significant hard freeze here. And it could be calendar-wise, this might be it for the season. Let's hope so, but we're getting towards that date anyway. But a rapid and very, very noticeable warm-up coming with summer conditions here likely by this weekend, and also many chances for precipitation with above wetter than normal week over much of the state, maybe except for the southeast corner for the short term. And looking again at field work, et cetera, it's going to be a little bit dicey, a little bit difficult with the continuing threat of rain. And I'll stop there and move to introduce our speaker for next week. And most of you know Manny Singh from our plant soils department here at MSU. He's going to be with us to talk about staging crop growth stages. And he's already been with us once this year, but we'll have him back for a return to talk about cropping management decisions coming up. So that's 1 week from today. Don't miss that. That's the 2nd of May.
I think at this time we're going to start taking some questions. So I'm looking in the chat. Looks like Jeff's been answering questions all along. Given that weather report, Jeff, I'm pretty sure my kids are going to try to put a tent up in the backyard this weekend. So,
It may be time. It may be time. Except for the rain, maybe.
I know. Oh, here's something from Dennis. He has a couple slides and he wants to share about wheat damage. I'll give you permission, Dennis. Do you if we can make Dennis a host? So he can share his slides, that would be great. I think we had another question
Or I can wait
about.
until the questions are done for Abby and Jeff too. It doesn't matter to me.
Okay. Oh, here's a question from Mike Stanton for Abby. So Mike says wheat acts like a cover crop by providing winter cover and living roots, however, is not as profitable as corn or soybeans. Because of this, it is not planted on as many acres as it should be. Is there any discussion at NRCS or FSA to provide an incentive payment for producers to plant more wheat?
So we do have financial assistance available for conservation practices through NRCS. And so producers who are considering changing their crop rotation to include wheat may be eligible for some of that financial assistance. So that is already offered through NRCS. It may not offset all the cost of that practice though. So that is a consideration, but producers can implement soil health management systems on cropland that does not include wheat too. There's still ways to get the ground covered and maintain that living root system.
Thank you. One of the earlier questions we had was a question about drought conditions in a field, when they will dry up, and when we can get the ground worked. Jeff talked about that a little bit. It looks like it's going to be pretty wet. So is that kind of the general answer there, Jeff?
Yeah, and of course, as usually, there's always, it depends, but because the soil texture obviously has a major role here as well. And so we're going to be able to get back to those or get into the fieldwork activity, obviously on the coarse textured soils first, and the heavier ones and especially given the forecast, if we do have opportunities, it probably will be on lighter soils here over the next week. But you also saw the map with the precip. So the farther north and west you go in the state, probably the lower the odds are that things will be dry enough, and in reverse of that in the southeast. So and I think one thing we've learned over time, I mean, Michigan's always a challenge in the spring to get things done, but you've got to be ready. And I know most people are at a moment, because sometimes the opportunity arrives and we didn't expect it, or it's a gift, but use it. That's I think we learn that season after season. And I suspect there will be some opportunities maybe in places like the southeastern lower here over the week, even with a wet forecast.
All right, thanks. Eric asks, with higher air temperatures starting Friday, we should not have any issues with chilling with cold rain water, correct?
Are we thinking about imbibition or what you know?
Yeah.
Yes, I yes. Our soil temperatures, as I showed earlier, are actually fairly mild for this time of the year. But given the forecast, especially in the southern half of the state with into the 70s and with strong sunshine at times, this should not be an issue. And if it anything, maybe the far north, but we're not to that point yet where people are really pulling the trigger on or able to get out. So I don't think that that's going to be an issue here in any time, certainly not in the near term future.
All right. For Abby, what are the major barriers to expanding long-term no-till acres, and how can these be overcome? That's a big question.
That is a very big question. No, it's a very good question. I think part of it is expanding the knowledge about long-term no-till and how to implement no-till successfully. And I think that part of that is, you know, talking today about the soil health management systems and how we can do that, and then increasing producers' knowledge of NRCS and how we can help them convert those acres.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Josh asks, what is the best option or cost-effective option to put cover on corn? Will rye work late in the season?
Yeah, rye is pretty inexpensive as far as cover crop species go, and it is our species that we can plant the latest into the season. So it's a good option after corn, especially if you fly it on in August or September.
In the past, NRCS had large mixes of cover crops that they recommended. Do farmers have more flexibility in choosing a 1, 2, or 3-way cover crop program?
So there are options for producers. They can pick a single species, they can pick a multi-species mix, and that can be as complex as they'd like to make it, as long as it meets the seeding windows. And we want to make sure those species get seeded at times when we know they'll germinate and grow successfully. So, but there
I've
are,
heard some, oh, sorry.
oh, there's just different levels of financial assistance based on the mixes that are selected.
I heard some talk that the seeding windows were going to be expanded. Is that true?
We are always looking at adapting our practice standards, and there's some studies going on at our plant material center right now about seeding windows and seeding rates. And so we always take that current information and adapt it into our standards when they're revised.
Thank you. I got a question from Mike. NRCS used to conduct annual tillage system residue cover assessments, or we used to call them transects. Are these still conducted? And if so, are the reports available?
No, they're not still conducted, so there's no reports about that.
I have a question for Dennis. How does this frost affect herbicide application on winter wheat, grass, and broadleaves? Previous sprayed and spraying today, frost and cold tonight, more wet coming. Your thoughts?
Yeah, so the cold temperatures definitely can impact herbicide application. As a general rule of thumb, you want to have an average temperature of 50 degrees for 3 days in a row and hit that middle day when you're making your herbicide application. So you don't want frost injury just the day before or frost injury just the day after. And the wheat growth stages are advancing quite rapidly. And so there are some herbicides that are no longer able to be applied because they can only be applied up to FEEC 6, and a lot of places are now into FEEC 7 or even approaching FEEC 8. So, and by this time, there may be enough canopy cover if the weed pressures are not great. If you have just a small amount of weeds out there, the wheat may shade it out, and you might not even need to put a herbicide on. So that's a walking and scouting fee each field, one field at a time to see what's really out there to make that decision. But yeah, we got to have warmer temperatures to put some of these herbicides on.
All right. Any other specialists want to chime in on herbicides? All right. Well, if you want to, maybe you can do it in the chat. Chris DeFonso has a little report she wants to let everybody know about. So I'm just going to read that out loud. There's 21 black cutworms in my trap on campus, more than normal, but still not an intensive capture. Likely moved on recent rain event. Okay. What is delay in planting when using cover crops due to soil not drying as? Oh, so how long do you need to delay plant when you're using cover crops? Do the soil not drying quickly with more ground cover?
Well, I think that is a pretty big question because it's going to depend on the species that are planted. Our non-winter killed species are going to help take up moisture in the spring too. I think the important part is just making sure that we're planting when the ground is ready instead of by a calendar, and getting those cover crops either terminated 2 weeks prior to planting or after planting, so that we get those proper conditions for planting.
Yeah, I like that soil temperature map you had, Jeff. That's really helpful. And I think Bill, somebody put the link in the chat too. So, Mike asked Jeff, is the rainwater going to be cold from the coming events?
And I think this one we have pretty high confidence. No, this will be, again, this will be a warm season type of situation this weekend. And so not expecting a We have had a couple of those events in the last month, but this should be warm. Convective rain, the upper atmosphere is relatively warm. So no, we're not looking for any cold. It will be relatively warm rainwater, well, relative for the time. But again, I think by Sunday, if we do see 80 degrees, everybody's going to say, what just happened here with a 25 degree start on Thursday morning, and then jumping literally into the season here in just a couple days. But the rain should be relatively warm.
Nice. Dennis, is Husky herbicide still good to spray on wheat?
Yes, Husky can be sprayed up to flag leaf. So products like 2,4-D, MCPA, Clarity, Curtail, Perfect Match, Osprey, PowerFlex, those are only up to Feek 6. So if you're planning on using those products, make sure you're go stage your wheat.
All
Yeah,
right.
no, for sure.
Eric asks, burn down apps made last week have been slow to take effect with colder temps. Can we expect a dramatic increase in efficacy by the end of the weekend? Did the frost events impact expected efficacy? Does anybody, is there a specialist on that can answer efficacy questions of herbicides?
That would be an Aaron or Christy question, I think.
Yeah. All right. Well, if they're on and they're listening, happy to chime in, or you could chime in the chat. Dennis, why don't you go ahead and get your slides ready? It looks like our questions are kind of slowing down. Mike said, Abby, it looks like NRCS is in good hands, and I think we all agree. So we really are happy that you're with us as our state agronomist. All right. Dennis, are you ready?
Sorry, I was on mute. Are you seeing my screen okay?
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's
I've
not in the
started.
ex
Yeah.
expanded slide.
That's all right. So wheat is in the jointing stage right now, and wheat can tolerate down to 24 degrees Fahrenheit for about 2 hours, and this is the approximate injurious temperature. And things to look for are death of the growing point, leaf yellowing or burning, lesions splitting or bending of the lower stem, and like a silage odor. And the yield effect can be moderate to severe at this growth stage. So I don't think any of us are in the boot stage yet, although just to the south of us, they are in the boot stage. And then that a critical temperature bumps up to 28. So, the way that you can get information is go to the MSU EnviroWeather, and then I always go to the weather tab here, and I go to data in demand. And after you go here, it shows up the list of weather stations, and so you can click on any weather station. I'll just go click on this one, and this one happens to be Mount Pleasant, and then I go to hourly data, and then in this chart, and I'll blow this up just a little bit. In this chart, you can see the temperature data. So here's air temperature here. And so at 1 a.m., this site was down to 30, 28, 27, 27, 26, 25. So we are getting really close to that temperature where we can see some frost damage. So if you are concerned about that, go to this EnviroWeather and then find a weather station near you to see what the hourly temperature is. But if you suspect damage, what you're looking for is the growing point, which is this is the developing head in the stem. If this frosts and then cells rupture, what can happen is that you can end up with sterile spikelets, like what you see in these two pictures over here in the bottom right. Sometimes you can find earlier on, the stem is kind of bent. That happens. Then this leaf burning is another one. And then if you're smelling a silage odor, you're probably looking at stems that are turning brown. And basically those plants are dead at that point. So I've got a lot of questions in the last couple of days about what the frost going to do. Hopefully this helps clear up a little bit. It's not an exact, it's not, well, it has to get down to exactly 24 before you could see injury or damage, but that's a ballpark for 2 hours at that time frame. You can kind of see, and we were getting pretty close to that here over the last evening.
Dennis, it's just Jeff, and I've just been looking at some values here from EnviroWeather, and we're right at that, or just maybe just above that threshold. In a large part with the Saginaw Valley and parts of the Thumb, unfortunately, we got close. So yes. That's especially that area of the state you're going to probably want to be watching or having a close look.
Yeah, and to assess for damage, you can't go out there today or tomorrow and look and find it. You got to wait 7 to 10 days before this damage will start to actually appear in the field. The leaf burning will show up a little bit more quickly, but the bending and this, you know, the death of the stems, that will show up later. And of course, the heads, you won't know that until they emerge. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Ruth, are these temps at plant or at the weather station height?
Well, so that's a good question. The temperature by the weather stations are reported at 5 foot ground height. Is that right, Jeff?
5 feet above the surface. That's right.
Yeah. So the soil will provide some warming buffer closer to the soil surface. So it depends on what growth stage you're at. The closer that growing point is to the ground, the little bit more buffering effect you'll have. So and perhaps wind might play a role in there too.
And some of these, I'm sorry, so, real quick, some of those rules are actually made with the air temperatures at 5 feet, even knowing that the actual temperature down, and Dennis, you're right on, the temperatures at the plant surface or on the leaf surface are probably a couple degrees colder than that, than the 5 foot. But sometimes those rules of thumb come because that's what we have data for and have observations for. So just to simplify things, I'll say that 24 Fahrenheit is a threshold. Many times that does refer to that 5 foot air temperature. And again, we're there are a lot of 20, 24 and a half, 25, 26s right now in that east central part of the state.
There were questions about herbicides affecting cover crops after wheat. And we had also had temperature and burn down questions. Karen attempted to answer that for Christy in the chat. There's a couple paragraphs in there if you want to check in on those. It looks like Christy has some research on those questions. And then if you need further information, go ahead and email Christy your questions. Great. I don't see anything new in the chat. Does anybody see that I'm missing anything? All right. I want to thank Abby again for being our guest today. And we appreciate everybody for being here with us this morning. And we hope you have a great week.